Tom from South Bay Pioneers in San Diego. And I believe you guys have been around since 61, correct?
That is correct.
And you help 40 people at a time, right? You can house 40 men at one time.
Absolutely. We have our facility is a residential recovery home for 24 men. And then in addition, we have 18 individual one-bedroom apartments located on our property, which are like the second phase of somebody's stay here at South Bay Pioneers.
Okay.
So the persons living in the apartments would be, you know, sober about a year or more. And then the guys that are living in the main house will be anywhere from, you know, just a couple of days sober to, you know, as much as a year. So it's a two-step process in terms of living here. Yeah.
So it's basically they come in, they clean house, and they get with the program, you know, so to speak. And then there's a turnaround where you kind of get them back into society.
Absolutely. So one of the unique things about the South Bay Pioneers is that a person that comes here, you know, they don't have to have money or a job or to be accepted. It's basically much like in AA, a desire to stop drinking. So what our primary motivator to bring somebody in the house is willingness. You know, if they're expressing willingness and want to make the changes in their lives that are conducive to being, you know, sober, happy, joyous, and free, we'll show them how we do it. So it's very much grounded in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, of course, we're not affiliated with AA,
yeah,
but we embrace the program wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. We definitely believe that the 12 steps are the solution to the malady of alcoholism and other addictions. But of course, we're real focused on AA. That's it. So we give, you know, the Pioneers is basically a conduit, you know. We make it really clear to everybody that comes here that we can't get them sober. You know, it's going to require action on their part. We can show them how we do it. It's peer counsel, one alcoholic helping another, the old-fashioned way. That's why it works. We're not messing with it.
You know, you said that you hit it right, the nail right in the head with you really can't get anyone sober if they don't want it. And it's funny because I've noticed in my dealings with people that have come to me for help that after a few days, you know, the brain starts to go into kind of a defense mechanism, and the will starts to come back, and the courage and the pride. And it really is, those are the worst traits that we carry through our lives, because it really tells us that we don't need help when we really do. And that's why no one else can break through that barrier, you know?
It's phenomenal, really. And it's funny that you bring it up that way, because I just was thinking this morning, as I was kind of giving some thought to our conversation, you know, it's interesting to me how a broken person like myself, when I got sober, could at any level come to a place like the South Bay Pioneers, and after a couple of days of exposure, somehow come to the conclusion that it wasn't that bad, or that, you know, that I, you know, could, you know, that a totally broken man to still have enough, to still have ego in place to think that you know, somehow I was better than who I was sitting around. You know, just it's puzzling. It's you know, as they say, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And that's, I'm just struck by that, you know.
It's you know what's unfortunate, because I think it's a double-edged sword. It's the cunning, baffling, powerful part of the disease. I think it's also inherent in human beings that we have these defense mechanisms, so we survive throughout history, that when things go really, really bad, we try to not push them away, but we try to overcome through some kind of misguided self-knowledge that these things aren't happening to us, so we can, right, you know, move forward and stay alive. And it's
yeah, I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah, it's a conundrum, and that's why it's so baffling and powerful. And the baffling part is that we think we have power and we don't. And that's really, yeah, it's that's that double-edged sword that gets us every time until we just let go absolutely and say, you know what, I am really fucked.
And yeah, exactly. And yeah, there lies the humility, right? And also, book, you know, our way of life has its advantages for all. So you hit it dead on, Steve. I mean, you know, it's not just exclusive to us. It's a human condition, you know.
Oh yeah.
That, you know, some level of denial and you know, okay, and you know, just to as a survival instinct for sure.
And it's you know, it's I guess it was good. It had its place. But now in today's society, survival in today's society is really just, I don't know if it's smarts or it's more discipline, going to work, you know, going to the store and buying food so you have it at your house, you know, stuff like, it's more of a day-to-day grinding. But then, you know, when it comes to that old animalistic sense of self and pride, that's where alcohol really hasn't changed. I mean, throughout mankind, you know, throughout time, you'd hear of things like that baffled people. The plague, for instance, you know, took out because no one knew about it. No one knew what to do. No one knew, you know, there's a cure. And not that this is like the same thing, but the cure is a different way of life and mentality, where it's not just some pill or some shot. But these things were always slammed upon, you know, mankind throughout history, and we had to overcome them to survive. I'd like to get into your story a little bit and what made you decide to be the director of the South Bay Pioneers Club over there in San Diego. You know, it's not something that should be taken lightly. You help a lot of people, a lot of men come through there. I'm sure you have hands-on dealings with them on a daily basis, as you've told me. And it's not just that you just got sober, you turned around and you made it part of your entire life. You know, let's get into a little bit of what was it like for you growing up and how you came about.
Sure. So I'll kind of lead my way. I'll tell you right off the top, the being the director here at South Bay Pioneers was kind of a happy accident, much like a lot of things in my recovery, not part of my plan. It certainly, you know, so much of being a sober guy is about, you know, just being where I'm supposed to be and understanding that I am where I am and doing what I'm supposed to be doing, regardless of what I think I should be doing. So, and I'll get back to that, but it was really quite by accident that I came to work here. But one of the beauties of being sober and in retrospect is that, you know, now I understand why I'm here and why I'm glad to be here and, you know, that type of thing. So, you know, I'll tell you, when I first came to South Bay Pioneers as a resident, back in the late 90s, I was born in 65, so I'm a 55-year-old guy. And you know, the way that I grew up, was, you know, in a pretty, middle-class family, working-class family. There was, you know, my dad was a hardworking guy and my mom worked, and I grew up with a younger brother, in our house. My dad had three kids from a previous marriage. And so we didn't really grow up with him, but some of the dynamics of that would come into play later on. But so, you know, I mean, my childhood was pretty normal. I was raised right by hardworking folks that were involved in our lives: Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, Little League, school sports, band, all, you know, all these kinds of things. They were involved and engaged and not a particularly religious family or anything like that. We didn't really go to church or you know, hardworking folks and a pretty normal, you know, or at least felt normal to me, childhood. Interestingly enough, with all of that in play, I always can remember just feeling like quite a part of that. And so my drinking started as a pretty young guy. I was 13 years old. By the time when I went into ninth grade, obviously 14 years old, and weekend warrior stuff with the other guys in school. And just from the get-go, my buddies had to be home at 11, and so did I. But I, you know, at 11, I didn't want to go home. You know, everybody else kind of wanted to go, and I didn't, you know. So I've heard people in meetings over the years describe their drinking as fun with problems, and then just problems. And, you know, the honest truth is I kind of started out fun with problems, you know. I don't know where that came from. You know, I mean, looking backwards, I know my mom had alcohol issues. My dad was not a drinker. The alcoholism itself, you know, kind of runs in my mom's side of the family. Lots of alcoholism. I didn't know any of that at the time. And my mom's drinking when I was young wasn't out of control. She would, you know, what we would call functional. She drank a lot of beer, and and you know, I will say, as a kid, I was pretty fond of getting a sip of that beer. You know, I always liked the taste of alcohol. I hear people say they didn't like the taste. I like the taste of alcohol. I like the effect produced by alcohol. So anyways, I started drinking, you know, as a young guy. Ninth and 10th grade, it got progressively worse. I started talking to drug and alcohol counselors by the time I was 15, 16 years old. It was, you know, to no avail, of course. So for whatever reason, as a kid, I was chomping at the bit to just be somewhere else. You know, I was just never comfortable where I was at, and that's kind of a constant theme throughout my drinking years. See, how can I kind of move through this quickly? There's so much, and it's always hard to kind of condense your story, right? But the reality is that I was troubled from the get-go with alcohol. You know, I liked it. I enjoyed it. I was a grandiose kind of drinker. I glorified and glamorized it. It seemed like a lifestyle that I wanted, you know, and I pursued it with with great diligence, if you will. There was a kind of a little dynamic, I think, that was in play. So, you know, I mentioned being kind of raised in a middle class family, and we were probably on the lower end of that spectrum, and there was a lot of emphasis placed on material stuff. My mom grew up very poor in Louisiana and Texas, and she was always trying to keep up with the Joneses, you know what I mean, and get us the nice stuff. But it was very clear to us that we didn't have the same things that a lot of our friends had. And you know, we were kind of like, we lived in an area where we were on the cusp of nicer areas of town. So like the schools we went to had like a lot of more well-to-do kids, and we were on the lower end of that spectrum, you know, so there was like this competition. So I kind of developed a weird sense of material worth being important. And that would kind of play. And I think that kind of fueled also my desire to get the hell out of town and not be at home, and, you know, looking for fancier friends, so to speak, and just kind of, you know, in this make-believe world, if you will. And so that just kind of sets the stage of, you know, how, what would be important to me kind of moving through my 20s. But again, like I said, I was just chomping at the bit. I, you know, just had a really bad case of the grass is greener on the other side. And after 10th grade, I started my junior year in high school at 16. I got kicked out of school and sent to a continuation high school, which I thought was cool at the time. And I didn't last there very long. I dropped out of that school. And then at 16, I was starting, you know, I was running away from home and staying out all night and kind of doing these things. And my parents were just besides themselves and, you know, just was really creating a lot of chaos at the house and, you know, was stealing everything that wasn't nailed down. And, it was just not a very good scene. And, you know, I was getting little trips to juvenile hall here and there and, you know, arrests, but not detained and, you know, that kind of stuff. And, it just didn't bother me, you know. And a constant theme around my house, you know, from about the time I was 13 to 16 was, you know, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? And that would come to play in my psyche later on as well. You know, by the time I got to AA, all I knew is that there was something wrong with me because people had been asking me that for so many years and I had no idea what was wrong with me. You know, thank God I found out, but, we'll get to that. At 16, I learned a word called emancipation, and I told my parents that if they didn't let me leave and go with this magazine crew selling magazines around the country, that I was going to get emancipated. And so my parents signed off and gave me permission to leave the state of California with this band of hooligans that sold magazines around the country. And
that's a great name.
Oh, my God. I mean, you talk about a recipe for disaster for a little alcoholic kid. I mean, this was a group of misfits and throwaways and runaways. And the whole thing is basically a hustle, you know. And they travel, they follow the sun and travel around the United States. And they hit, you know, they go door to door and they work in downtown areas and on college campuses. And they just like scam people, you know. The company, the clearinghouse, the magazine clearinghouse is somewhat legitimate. I mean, you could actually get what you ordered, but the whole thing is just built on, you know, getting some money out of somebody and getting out of town. And, so this was my proving ground. I was already full of shit as a Christmas turkey. And then these folks taught me how to really turn that up a notch. And it's an absolute, we were talking a little bit about survival earlier. It is all about survival. I mean, this, the whole little racket is a form of indentured servitude. The people that run these places kind of own the kids, you know, they know that they got you where they want you. They travel you around and put you up three or four people in a hotel room and give you $10 a day to eat on and do your laundry on and survive on. And you're on your own from there. So, you know, you go out for the day and you try to meet your quota, and then you come in, and if you haven't met your quota, then you get your $10 draw and they put a negative on you, and, you know, they let you know about it. You know, you owe us $200, you owe us $500, you owe us, you know, you're indebted to them unless you're good at it. And then you might, you know, then you get a bigger draw and you get a little more money. And, you might get your own hotel room or share a room with just one person instead of four, and, you know, that kind of stuff. So, it was, man, what an experience. I can tell you that, the upside of the whole situation was that, I was fairly good at selling magazines to people, and getting their money from them. So it was both a good and bad experience at the same time. I think only a person that's gone through something like that would understand it. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. on one end of the spectrum, you know, I watched this guy that ran this crew knock people around, you know, smack them. and I, you know, watched him rail out lines of cocaine to people who did well, you know. And I mean, the guy was essentially a pimp, you know. You know, that held some fascination for me. You know, I mean, it was both scary and exciting all at the same time.
It was downright criminal, it sounds like.
It certainly was. They're notorious. They have magazine crews and these like chemical company crews, and they still exist. How they do it, I don't know. But I mean, they literally, they're just it's criminal, nothing short of. But I didn't know that at the time. You know, I didn't know that. It's looking back, and oddly enough, I would develop some skill sets that would serve me later, you know, to the good, which is another part of the recovery story. And I'll get back to that. So anyways, the long and short of it is I ran around with this crazy ass magazine company, hustling, you know, basically women. You get to the point where you kind of can pick out, you know, who you want to talk to. And I'm an old bald guy now, but at one time I was young and a little prettier and had some hair, and you know, it was, you could run up to a gal and flirt with her a little bit and tell her what you're doing. And I'm from California and you're in Philadelphia and you're on some college campus and I'm in this contest and I'm going to win a trip to Paris and I'll take you with me, and, you know, blah, 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 just nonsense. And, you know, get $30-$40 worth of cash out of them and then take off to the next one. You know, so it was a hustle, and it was a survival thing. I mean, you just had to keep moving, and you had to be quick on your feet. And I got beat up a couple of times because I flirted with the wrong girl, or, you know, these kinds of things. And you had to scratch to survive. The downside was that it was all make-believe, right? I mean, everything was a lie. When I was a little kid, my mother used to tell me that I should be a politician or an attorney, with no digs on those two professions. But, she just said, because I just talked. She said I could tell a lie with a straight face when I was a little kid. That just kind of blew her doors, you know? Hence the expression when I said earlier, the full of shit is a Christmas turkey, that I got that from my mom. And I just was always kind of that way. It was just my tendency. And the magazine thing just, you know, enhanced that. And I would get to that point that I was just, you know, I believed my own bullshit, you know? And I lived in a world of make-believe. And I did that for a couple of years. I traveled across the country with them over the course of a year. I got to Boston. I told a 20-year-old woman that I was 21 years old, but I was 17 at the time, and shacked up with her in Boston for a few months until she got tired of me, or I got tired of being there. I don't really recall. And I came back to San Diego, made my family a bunch of promises, broke all those promises, called the magazine company up, and they flew me back to Pittsburgh, and I traveled back across the country with them. So here I am, a 16, 17-year-old kid, and I'm running around, you know, major metropolitan cities. I'd never been out of El Cajon, California, where I grew up prior to that. And I thought I was doing something. You know, I just really, all my friends were in El Cajon, and I was seeing the world, you know. It was an adventure, but some major life lessons learned in that experience as a kid running with wolves, you know? So I come back to San Diego, leave the magazine thing. And then from there, the drinking really takes off. You know, by this time I'm almost 18 years old, and I get a couple little wind up working at a hotel downtown San Diego, and the club, it was called the Executive Hotel and Spa, and it was a really nice place. And I got a job as a night auditor, so I'm working in a fancy hotel, and I start thinking I'm a fancy guy because I work in a fancy hotel. And I'm around folks that are well-to-do, and you know, the guests have money, and the place had a club called the Cuyamaca Club, where a lot of wealthy folks that lived in San Diego would come and drink and hang out, tip well. And of course, at this time, I'm basically 18, 19 years old, and I have not just a drinking habit, but I have I have a cocaine habit as well by this point. And I need other people's money to buy that. You know what I mean? Because I don't have really any of my own. I work at the front desk at a hotel, but I know where to get it. So I kind of become a middleman. I'm a salesman and I'm personable, and you know, I'm not completely out of control. So you know, these folks that would probably otherwise have nothing to do with me are happy to have me around because I know where to go get the stuff, right? And so that would kind of be the little pattern for the next 10 years or so, you know, just this life of the party, middleman, know where to get the stuff, hanging around a lot of folks that I really had no business hanging out with. Again, coming back from that kind of that magazine thing, you know, I had learned how to kind of adapt and overcome to any kind of social situation. So I became very, just, I was in a crowd of bikers one night and running with folks from La Jolla, you know, the next night, or sometimes both in the same night. And, didn't really fit in anywhere. I fit in everywhere. I had really my own personal identity at that point. So the hotel job would turn into a good thing as far as my drinking and using went, because the industry was just very conducive. I generally would work like 3 to 11, so I could get off at 11 and drink and party all night and sleep in the morning. And when I was young, I could do it, right? And then get up and go to work at 3 o'clock, and you could get fired and get another job at another hotel just like that, because they were always hiring. And or you could quit, which is mostly what I did. I never really got fired. I always, you know, get out the door before that happened. The other part of you know, that industry is that you know, people are vacationing and they're having fun, and they're, you know, they're drinking and using, and you know, hotels have bars, and it was a way to meet my habits without it costing me a lot of money. So you know, everything was, you know, some kind of everything in my life was a hustle, you know. It just kind of losing my train of thought, Steve. Sorry. But it was all, you know, it was very conducive. So again, I would work in the hotel and then the travel industry for about the next 10 years. And it also was conducive to picking up and moving other places, which that's what I was trying to go to, was that, you know, I was never really happy where I was at. And I tease oftenly, you know, that I was kind of like the poster child for Greyhound, you know. I was like the king of the geographic. I just pick up and run at a moment's notice. I, you know, so between the magazine thing, traveling all around the states, when I stopped doing that, I came back to San Diego. Then I wound up in Tahoe for 5 years, and I went to Reno. After Reno, I went to Seattle. After Seattle, I came back to San Diego. San Diego to San Antonio. I mean,
there's a shocking culture switch, Reno to Seattle.
Oh my God.
That's
like calling in a favor. Basically, I had a friend that I'd worked with up in Tahoe that had moved up to Seattle. I had been up in Tahoe. Have you ever been to Lake Tahoe?
Okay. Oh yeah.
Beautiful place.
That's how I know Reno.
Yeah. We used to say, Reno, so close to hell, you could see sparks. Sparks, Nevada. But the long and short of it is I had worked at all the big properties on the hill. I was burning bridges up in Tahoe, and I needed to get off the mountain, which is how I wound up in Reno. I actually went to treatment for the first time in Reno at a place called St. Mary's. It's like a 30-day rehab. I'll just tell you one quick story. The way I wound up there was that I had basically emptied my bank at my hotel job. And back in those days in the hotel, they give you your own bank and it was in a safety deposit box, and you know, you keep the cash. Well, I did a lot of unauthorized borrowing, stealing as we know it now. And so the long and short of it was, is I cleaned out my bank and I finally got caught at work one day because I didn't have any change. I didn't have any money to operate my drawer on when I went in for my shift. You know, I was borrowing money from other people's banks to run my drawer and just craziness, you know. And I think I had, you know, not showed up for work for a day or something. And they said, what's going on with you? You know, I've been drinking and, you know, again, I had this uncanny knack for being well received wherever I worked. And a big part of my story is people enabling me to do the things that I did, because, you know, I'm trying to stay humble here. But the reality was, is that I was a fairly likable guy. I had a good sense of humor. You know, I'd start a job and I'd move up quickly and people liked me. And I was a great starter, but a horrible finisher, you know. So all these employers, I mean, I can't tell you how many employers I have that should have had me thrown in jail. But they didn't. They give me another chance. You know, they say, it's okay, we forgive you, you're a good guy, just go get some help. And, you know, just don't do it again. And I say, okay, I won't, you know. And then I wouldn't, but I'd quit. So I wouldn't do it to them again. You know, I would I'd go somewhere else and do it to them instead. You know, I'd find a new victim. That kind of thing. Anyway, so that's how I wound up in Reno. I went to treatment down there. And then I got an apartment. Well, that lasted all of about, I don't know, maybe a week. I went through the 30-day program. I was off the mountain. My mom came up to see me in Reno. She helped kind of get me set up in a little studio apartment. That was all fine and dandy. She went back to San Diego, and I'm guessing it wasn't a week later, I'm drunk. Drunker than in Reno, I got thrown out of the same bar twice in one night.
That's impressive.
I bring it up only, I mean, it's no big deal to get thrown out of a bar. We probably all have, but this is just kind of, I always thought was kind of a funny story. I had been in there, and apparently
twice in one night, though, it's gotta well, be.
Well, yeah.
I've gotten thrown out of
bar. In this case, I had said something off color, I think, to a woman in the bar, and I was asked to go. So in the middle of a snowstorm in Reno, Nevada, I stumbled down the street. I crossed the street. I went back down the street the direction that I had just come from, crossed the street again, and came back to the bar that I had been in, not realizing that it was the same bar. And I stumbled in the door. And it was a double door system because of the snow, right? So you open in, one door closes, then you open the next door. And I get in there, and I take about three steps in, and it's starting to look vaguely familiar to me, you know? And I'm going, God, you know, I just remember being really grateful that I had found another bar. And I got in there, and I got about six steps in the door. And that's when my eyes locked on the guy that had thrown me out, you know, 15 minutes earlier. And I went, oh. And then it hit me. And as I locked eyes with him, the guy just kind of shook his head side to side and started moving toward me. And the next thing I know, he's got me by the scruff of the neck, you know, my jacket. And he bounces me off both of those doors and throws me into the street, into the snow. And yeah, that was a rough night.
I was on both sides. I was a bouncer for many years. I got thrown out of a club once doing something you weren't supposed to be doing in a bathroom, some powdery substances. And that I was like so ashamed because I'm the one who usually does it, and now here I am, and I'm like, this is how it turns on you. You know, you go from being someone who not really security, I guess, you know, bouncing is, to be honest, bouncing in most of these bars is kind of like a two for one. You get like drinks and you get to meet women, and then once in a while you get to exercise some aggression, you know, and it's all in the name of doing the right thing. You know, I'd never hit anybody that didn't try to hit me first, so you know, I wasn't like a big fighter, you know, I didn't try to take out my anger on anyone. But you went from, it's like going from cop to criminal,
right? Yeah, I mean, I didn't get thrown out of a lot of places, and I was, I, you know, I always fancy myself a lover, not a fighter. However, you know, I've been on the receiving end of more than one bouncer, and rightfully so. And that it's funny that you mentioned it, because I, you know, like I always considered myself, you know, likable and generally friendly, and I wasn't usually off color or rude, and you know, but that was kind of like that progression, you know, thing. I mean, that would turn out to be kind of a little wake up call for me later on. You know, I realized, man, I'm really kind of getting, you know, out of control, and I'm saying some things I don't really remember what I said, and you know, I never, you know, I wasn't usually a person who was crude and crass, you know, but I know that, and I don't even really remember what I had said to that woman that night. I just know that it was not right, you know, and it was certainly less than honorable, but nonetheless, that would be, you know, kind of where my drinking was starting to go. You know, I was kind of, you know, finally, you know, and I was still, heck, I think I was only 25, 26 years old or something like that at that point, you know, and, anyways, yeah, so I'm like moving that direction, and so I was in Reno, kind of speed ahead. I wind up in Seattle, and I get a job with Holland America Cruise Line, and I'm working in their corporate office. I'm not working on the ships, but I aspire to. When I was in Tahoe, I had managed to get a job from out of the hotel industry into a timeshare organization that owned its own travel agency. And I was booking trips and travels and cruises. And this is in the mid 80s. So cruising was super expensive. It was mostly older folks. There wasn't a million ships in the, you know, like there is now, and that type of thing. And again, I was a young guy, and I was, you know, selling travel, and it was incoming calls. So it was easy to do, because people were calling you to say, hey, what can you tell me about this? And as a result, I got to go on a couple of cruises as a young guy. I went through the Panama Canal. You know, again, all this stuff is lending itself to this belief that I'm like, I'm a mover and a shaker. You know, I'm living the life. You know, my friends are still in El Cajon. I'm in the Panama Canal, dude, you know. And I'm drinking on a ship with, you know, on the Royal Princess, which is the biggest ship at the time. And, you know, everybody else is sitting home watching the Love Boat. I'm on the Love Boat, bro, you know. And, you know, so all this kind of stuff is feeding my little ego. And, yeah, I'm out of place where I am, but yet there I am, you know. And so I get to work for the cruise company, and, you know, it's basically a juice hire. You know, a friend of a friend says, yeah, send him in, give me an application. And, you know, I had some travel experience and some hotel industry, so it was related. And, so I get in there, and I get the opportunity to go on a couple of cruises with them up to Alaska, and they called them fam trips, and it's supposed to be working, you know, kind of a working trip. And of course, I'm smashed. I'm just smashed on the ship the whole time. I completely like failed to even make it into one port. And yeah, it just wasn't going well. And then, you know, all honesty, when I'm in Seattle, I was living up on kind of off Capitol Hill area, which is, I don't know if you know the area, but it's a wild part of town. It's wilder today than it was then, but it was weird then. And I mean, there's some of everybody there. And that's where I lived up on the top of Madison, and just the other side of the hill is what they call the Columbia District, or the CD. And that's where you buy crack. And I bought a lot of it. And so the job at the cruise line didn't really last very long, and neither did my nice pad overlooking the Puget Sound from Capitol Hill either, you know. So that the wheels came off in about a year there, and I once again came back to San Diego with my tail between my legs, and, looking for help from mom and dad. And grandparents were still alive at that time. And, you know, just kind of, I'm sitting here thinking about some of the stunts I pulled, and, you know, as you're taking me back down memory lane here. I was having a hard time finding work, and I got it in my head that if I had a car, I could find work. And my grandfather said, okay, I'll give you the money to buy a little car. So you can get a job, do something with your life because you're, you know, 26 years old and you got nothing going and you're just in trouble and they, you know, the whole bit. So Gramps gives me some money to buy a car. And of course, I can't just, you know, go buy a car to get me somewhere. I have to go find a little Porsche.
That's a fancy car. A
Porsche, yeah, because I, you know, I got this material thing going. I find a poor man's Porsche, a 914, little square one. And that's going to be my car. I got my heart set on it. And they say, okay, we'll get you the damn car if it'll make you happy. And you'll go get a job and pull your head out of your ass and you know, do something. Okay, I will. So Gramps gives me the money. And I'm going to go buy the car. And 3 hours later, I'm sitting at my buddy Phil's house. And we're snorting that money. And we decide to go to Texas. So I take, you know, I think it was about $3,000 at the time that my grandfather gave me. And Phil and I jump in his Blazer and take 6 days to go to Texas and spend all that money in every strip bar between here and San Antonio. And that's the epitome of how my drinking went. You know what I mean? I mean, that story right there is just how I drank. You know, if I got anything from anyone, any money, I just blew through it, wasted it, didn't care what they had done for me. I mean, it just, that's how it was. And sadly, I would, you know, if that would continue on for a lot of more years. The problem was, is that I quit getting those little windfalls, you know, of money.
Yeah, you lucked out.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there were some attempts to try to straighten up. When I got to San Antonio, I'd been there for a couple of years and I'd blown through a couple of different hotel jobs and things were getting bad. I met a woman who I liked, and since I kind of needed a place to live, I married her. And I joined the Army at 28 years old, thinking that would straighten me out. And I wasn't entirely wrong. I quit doing drugs while I was in the Army. But I certainly did not stop drinking. In fact, I started drinking with a vengeance at that point. And so my Army career would wind up ending in about 2 years because I got really drunk and went AWOL. And, you know, doing a no-call, no-show at a hotel is not that big a deal. They get over it pretty quick. You know, okay, we'll find another guy to work the front desk. Bye. Nice knowing you. You know, the whole Army thing where you sign that paper and you become property of the United States Army mm-hmm. failed to register with me. So, you know, the ramifications of going AWOL and just deciding I don't want to be in the Army anymore, you know, those don't look good on your record. And unfortunately,
government doesn't like that when you bail
they,
on them.
They really don't. I mean, they give you uniforms and money, and they expect you to be there.
Yeah.
You got to show up. Yeah, they want you there at a certain time, like every day, all the time. Yeah. So,
is this going to be a daily thing, sir?
Yeah, pretty much. Well. And but the funny thing was, is it was, you know, it was kind of like everywhere else that I had been with Steve. I mean, I went into the Army, you know, I was polished. I was, you know, spit shine creased and I, you know, I made rank fast and I got special duty and you know, I was a great starter and a horrible finisher. And, you know, so like, it's like I'm there one day and you know, well, you know, thought of and things are going really well. And then one day I'm just not. And it's like, what the hell happened to Tom? Where did he go? He went AWOL. What do you mean he went AWOL? Tom, are you kidding me? What's wrong? You know, so my AWOL experience led me back to San Diego, and then realizing that, you know, I couldn't really live on the land, AWOL from the United States Army. So I actually turned myself into the Shore Patrol here in San Diego, And went back to Texas to face the music. And that happened in a pretty quick period of time. It was over, you know, a few weeks or whatever.
So what happened? What did you get?
So what happened was they gave me an option. They could, you know, give me an Article 15, charge me. I could go before a judge, face penalties, or I could take a discharge. And the discharge they offered to me was they call it an OTH discharge, which is other than honorable. You know, without really investigating it, I took that discharge and ran, because what I wanted to be gone. You know, I just didn't want to be there. You know, I really didn't give it any thought at the time as to, you know, what that really meant. I didn't want to go to jail. You know, now what I would learn later is that if I'd have been charged with an Article 15, that I could have probably stayed in the Army, that I would have got knocked down some rank, I would have paid some fines, and it would have been fine. But I didn't know that, you know. And somehow in my mind, an other than honorable discharge sounded better than dishonorable. But, you know, so, I mean, basically you have an honorable, a general under medical, other than honorable, and dishonorable, you know. So I'm second from the bottom. And you know what? I didn't know at the time how much that would impact my psyche, you know, because that was not the kid my parents raised. I wasn't raised to be a dishonorable guy, you know. I was in the Cub Scouts. I was in the Boy Scouts. I was in the DMLA, which is part of the Masonic thing, you know. I was a good kid. You know, everybody told me so. I wasn't supposed to be that way. I wasn't supposed to be a dishonorable guy, you know? Yeah, I mean, I think that's when things started kind of registering for me, you know, just that you're other than honorable. And I did not like the way that sounded. I really didn't, you know? I mean, I wanted to be out of there and off, but, you know, that right there was a chink in my armor, you know? I hear a lot of folks say, you know, when they're sober, that they have no regrets, you know, now or whatever. And man, I don't agree with that. You know, I have regrets. You know, I don't live in them as a sober guy, but I have them, and I'm aware of them. You know, I don't want them buried away where I can't feel them. You know, I want to feel them.
Yeah, I tend to lean the same way.
I want to feel my mistakes. I want to touch my scars. I want to know the things that I don't want to be today. And that's one of them. You know, I did not like that. You know, and it would get in my way. It would prevent me at certain times moving forward in my life of applying for certain kinds of jobs and things that I could have very easily gone to do. Because it would have been a barrier, you know, or is a barrier. And it's fine. I mean, I own it. It's okay. It hasn't, prevented me from having a life or making money or any of that kind of stuff, and having, you know, the things that we want from life. But it bothers my mind, and I think it should, you know. And honestly, you know, at the time I didn't like it, but I mean, that was something that I learned in sobriety, was to, you know, like it says, we don't want to forget the past, but we don't want to shut the door on it either. And, so that's it. So I'll try to race forward. We've been on for a minute here. That would be the beginning of the end. My drinking, you know, after that, my livelihood was basically, you know, room to room, hotel room to hotel room, couch to couch, you know, house to house, woman to woman, just, you know, using and sponging off of anyone and everyone I could. Employment would become scarcer. The drug addiction would move from cocaine to crystal meth, because it was cheaper and available. And man, what a nasty drug. And of course, just drinking, and all of that would lead me, you know, through the 90s, kind of culminating at the end of the 90s to the Salvation Army is kind of where I started. So
I went to an ARC program downtown San Diego here, and checked in, and I went there after a brief stay at a place called Sharp Mesa Vista Hospital, which is a psych ward, and because I had nowhere else to go, you know, and I'd wound up in the psych ward, and they gave me a list of phone numbers to call, and I called the Salvation Army, and they said, you know, come and talk to us, and they said, you can come in, you know. And so that is where I really get my first taste of any kind of recovery or sobriety. That was a 6-month program, and probably familiar with ARC programs. They have them around the country. And of course, I wouldn't stay sober, but I did have some hope of sobriety at that point. You know, I heard some things, and I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had gone to that treatment program in Reno all those years before, but I didn't retain any of that, you know? And, so the Salvation Army kind of introduced me to AA again, and the idea of being sober. So from like 98, 99, I'm sorry, I went to Sally in 94, and then wouldn't make it to the South Bay Pioneers as a resident until 98. So I struggled in and out, and things got better, but they didn't stop. You know, I was still doing that. I was doing that thing where, okay, there's something wrong. I need to get right. I need to be a decent person. I'm a jerk. But I don't want to give up drinking because I need it, you know? And I don't really know anything else. So I bounced in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. You know, I'd get 90 days here and there, and then I'd drink, pull the roof in on myself and do that kind of deal. And finally, I mean, even here at Pioneers, I came to live here and was sober, you know, while I lived here. And then... but I couldn't maintain it. I was just like the 90-day wonder. And, my train of thought here. I didn't tell you my sobriety date. My sobriety date is May 25th, 2004. So I'm sober 16 years now. And I always like to tell people that that's not my first sober date, but I certainly hope it's my last one. Prior to that, I had gotten sober in 1999, and I stayed sober for 5 years and then had a slip. And I think it's important to talk about that a little bit because of the lesson that came out of it. But I really do want to share a little bit about my sobriety with you. I don't know how long your interviews usually go, but I can see here.
About an hour.
So let me move to that real quickly here. In 99, I finally got sober. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. Things were going well. Tons of meetings, lots of service commitments, very engaged. I started going to school. You probably know, like I do, it's amazing how many like sober guys I see in general, and I would include myself in this, that could have like absolutely nothing going on, get sober, and all of a sudden have everything in the world going on, just opportunity everywhere, excelling at everything they do, you know, and just, you know, just moving forward. And that's what was happening to me. I mean, at 3 and 4 years sober, you know, I was going to school. I'm a high school dropout. I'm in college. And I'm on the dean's list. I'm an honor roll student, you know. I'm working. I'm making money, and you know, things are just on fire. And I start thinking I'm doing something, you know. And I circle back to that old way of thinking that maybe the grass is greener on the other side. Maybe it wasn't that bad, you know. I have a nice lady friend, and I'm kind of getting, you know, pretty committed to her, and I'm going to school, and then I meet a girl at school, and I decide, oh, maybe I want to run off with her instead. And next thing you know, I'm doing things that are just not conducive. I painted myself into a corner, and you know, I'm forgetting my program and where all this stuff comes from. And I think I'm doing it, and I wind up drinking after 5 years of sobriety. And it was a brief interlude, but it was, boy, was it a wake-up call. And that was back in 2004. And I bring it up because it, I always go back to that place in the book where it says there'll come a time when we're without defense, you know, against that first drink. And you know, after I took a drink after 5 years of sobriety, I was just stunned, you know, and I couldn't understand why. And you know, my sponsor said, well, you know, if you're engaged in behavior that's not conducive, you know, like lying to your girlfriend and, you know, cheating on her with somebody else, and doing these types of things, then you're not really being honest with yourself or her, or living by the principles. And you landed yourself at that place where you were without defense. And I'm like, son of a bitch, you mean I got to be a good guy all the time? He said, yeah, you know, it says that part in the book where it says every day is a day, you know, when we must carry these thoughts and actions. And I'm like, holy shit, you know? So it was just a big, powerful lesson in how much responsibility there is in being sober, and how much action should be taken, and all of it's well worth it, right? So you asked me how at the beginning of this I came to be at Pioneers, and so I lived here as a sober guy with a few years of sobriety. In that first period, I was asked if I would serve as a volunteer on the board of directors here. In that first period, things were popping for me. I mean, it just, you know, almost had it too easy. Anyways, I had served on the board here, and I had service commitments. So I was just very engaged in stuff. And then, work wise, I mean, I had good opportunities work. I mean, when I lived at the South Bay Pioneers, the guy that worked in the office got me a job at the KOA as a janitor. And that was the first and last job that I ever looked for. You know, every other job that I've had since then, and there's been a few, including this one, were offered to me, you know. And so what had happened is, after that relapse and after I had been sober for a few years again, the guy that was running the house here gave 2 weeks notice really fast and left. And the board asked me if I would fill in here temporarily. And that was like 13 years ago. So when I say I got here by mistake, it kind of was. I mean, it was supposed to be a temporary thing. I was going to be doing it alongside of my business, which I had at the time. I tried to do both at the same time. I had a little swimming pool repair and cleaning business. And thought I could do both, but it was just really too much. So I wound up letting go of the business, selling the business in order to work here. And man, what a reward. I mean, this is the South Bay Pioneers is a place. I mean, it's an amazing place. It's, you know, storied. The history here is very rich. You know, it's nothing quite like the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, again, we're not affiliated with AA, but so much of what happens here is rooted in the 12 steps. We have a large meeting hall, and, you know, under normal circumstances, pre-COVID, this facility is traversed by, you know, upwards of 1,000 people a week attending some 17 AA meetings, and there's just all of the, you know, ensuing fellowship, social events, and things like that that happen. It's an amazing place. And, you know, it's funny, frequently people will say, oh, this is Tom. He runs the South Bay Pioneers. And I always say,
no, God runs the pioneers. I just sign the checks, you know, and it's kind of that kind of place, you know. It just, it does, it's got a life of its own. It's not something that, you know, I don't think you could create this place. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously it was created at one time, but if you tried to go out on purpose and make this place, you know, it just, you couldn't do it on your own. It's almost a naturally occurring, you know, phenomenon. So the guys that founded this place had some good foresight to do it, create it, the space, and then let it do its own thing. And that's probably the reason that it's here some, you know, 58, 59 years later, is that it operates today very much the way that it did back in the early 60s, you know, which is there's rules to follow and chores to do and schedule to meet and meetings to attend. And nobody's trying to reinvent the wheel. It's just very much, it's keep it simple. And we do, and I do, and man, it's a thing of beauty. God, I feel bad about spending so much time in the drunk part because, I think what I really want to convey to anybody who might be listening more than anything is that, not only is sobriety, attainable, it's amazing. You know, that a guy like me can even, you know, lead the life that I live today. This morning we were talking in our house meeting about grace, you know, and I really feel like I understand and have experienced grace, you know, that undeserved gift. The whole idea, I mean, for many years I would hear people say, you know, if I got what I deserve, it certainly wouldn't be this. And I didn't necessarily have an appreciation for that, but I do today, you know. I know my place in the universe, if you will. You know, I try to stay right-sized. I want to be that way. It's truly amazing. When I got to the program, I thought that people were full of shit, you know. Go figure. I was full of shit, you know. So,
it's the same attitude that I believe that we all have when we come into.
Absolutely, you know,
this can't possibly work. It's too easy, and we're complex people that can take a certain program and fuck it up royally. And that's why we don't usually have just one sobriety date. We have one that we talk about, but. How many people do you know actually
very get sober
the first time? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why places like yours are so vital, because sometimes some are sicker than others, and it takes a little time for them to realize that this is what they want.
It's this morning our we were talking about gratitude, and that led us to kind of that. Idea when we're talking about gratitude and grace and the number of persons who have the opportunity to get sober versus the number of persons who actually do, you know, and we see that here, you know. So in a given year, you know, we'll turn over 100 beds, you know. We'll have 24 guys in our main house at a time, you know, so we'll turn over those beds 100 times, and out of any given 25 guys that are here, you know, a handful of them will stay sober, you know, and get sober and experience the life that, you know, we've been so freely given. Right. And I can never, put enough emphasis on that to these guys, you know, that, and we do it frequently. And if anybody's ever been to treatment, I'm sure they had that question posed to them, you know, look around the room. Only three people are gonna, you know, be here. Are you one of the three? And that,
I hate that. I hate that because it's such a. I hate when I see statistics on something that is so. It relies so much on what you do, not what some other outside entity or program or reading material. It's a program itself. If you don't get sober, yeah, it's your own damn fault. And that's what people don't realize. There's no magic medicine, no magic pill, or there's no paragraph I can read that, oh, wow, I got it. Good, I'm cured. And people are like, that doesn't work. I'm like, you don't work. You don't understand it. If you don't do the work,
it's action. And you know that. So these are the kinds of things that we continue to pound home. And you know, we don't make any bones about it. I mean, you know, we tell a guy here very quickly, you know, we understand we're not going to scare you into getting sober. We're not going to guilt you into being sober. We're not going to beg you into getting sober. You're going to do it because you choose to or not. You know, we're going to give you the room to do it. That's what we're going to do. We're going to give you the room to move about the cabin and get the work done, you know. You know, and so we just try to model those principles, you know, the gratitude, the action, the service, you know, service and Alcoholics Anonymous and getting out of yourself. And you know, my sponsor tells me all the time, the only way I can take my beady little eyes off myself is to be doing something for you, you know? And so I do it. I don't always want to do it for you. I'd rather sit on my ass, or I'd rather go play golf, or, you know, I'd rather go look at my car. Or, I don't know. Just, you know, I'm not, my natural state isn't, oh, let me do something for you, you know? I like the way I feel when I'm not thinking about me, you know. And these days,
it's so easy to just go and look in a mirror and say, "Look how much pain I'm in," instead of saying, "Look how great my life is. Look what I have."
Yeah, it's
the same shit.
I mean, it's truly a gift, and you know, I you know, so much of it is perception. And I got phone ringing in my bathroom. I'm here every Saturday morning, and we start at 6 o'clock in the morning. We have a house meeting on Saturday mornings with our guys at 7. They go out and do chores until about 8:30. Saturday is like a big production day here at South Bay Pioneers. Now it's a lot less exciting right now with the COVID. I mean, this is a weird time for us here as our facility is currently shut down to the public. You know, we're doing some.
I'd like to remind people, though, that you are at the recovery house while this interview is taking place, while you're on my show. So it's not like you're just sitting there, you know, thumbing around through notes. You're actually trying to accomplish things, you know. So I like, you know, people to take that into account, you know, and it's important that people realize you're actually.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it being noticed. You know, in all honesty, I mean, it's not the South Bay Pioneers has become very much a part of my life. You know, we talk about AA being a way of life, and it really has become that for me. The Pioneers is a part of that. You know, my job is it's interesting. You know, it talks in the book about, you know, most of us don't make full time work of this, or I think it even says, nor do we think that a lot of benefit would come from it. So this is it's an interesting thing to be a guy that works at a recovery home, because we're not like a clinical model. We're not treatment, right? So I'm not a drug counselor, and I'm not a drug and alcohol counselor. I have no special training. You know, I know how to pay the bills and keep the lights on and help guys get sober. I mean, it's layman. It's peer counsel. It's not anything other than that. We're not a rehab. We're not, you know, it's not treatment. It's not a clinic. It's just an old fashioned 12 step house, you know, and that I can do because that's, you know, what I was taught. But the flip side of that is that you're talking about 24 guys and lots of dynamics and lots of personalities, lots of drama, lots of ego, lots of different situations, and, you know, and that's just the 24 in the house. And I got the apartment people. That's another deal, you know, and we have, I have men and women there, in the apartment. So, again, I hate to call it a love hate thing, because there's times when you just go, oh my God, those damn alcoholics, you know? And then other days you're just like, oh my God, I love my alcoholics and love my people. This is my family. So it's not any different than anything else. Really. It really is, You know, it's a my life happens 7 days a week, you know, 24 hours a day on any given day, right? And the same goes for this place. I mean, you know, my phone 24 hours a day. You just never know. Most of the time, things go pretty smooth. And, you know, when they don't. Well, wow, thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate it. I really do wish I would have spent a little more time in the recovery end of things with you. But it just...
Well, you did. It's all part of your story. You know, it's all part of your story. And the fact that you are doing it while you're at the recovery house telling your story is going to help the people that, you know, not only are there, but listen to this
podcast. Well, I think what you're doing is an awesome thing. I mean, the more positive information people can tap into, you know, the better off. I mean, you know, that's one of the things I tell these guys all the time is that the opportunity is everywhere. You know, you will see it if you just open your eyes and look for it. It really is. You know, what you're doing here on this broadcast, amazing opportunity to share experience, strength, and hope. You know, and I'm certainly going to encourage folks to check this out, invite folks to check out our website, South Bay Pioneers, and we share as much positive information as we can all over the place. I mean, there is just no, what does it say? We're not a gloom lot, right? And we're not. I mean, we're, you know, I say it all the time. I'm a sober guy, and I am not mad about it. You know, and that's a good way to be. So, thank you so much for all day long. All day long, brother.
Happy choice to three.
All right, Steve. Thanks.
I'll talk to you later, okay? Thanks for being on the show.
Bye.